Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ira Melman reporting. An attack on an ISIS stronghold. Kurdish fighters backed by U.S. airstrikes recaptured some areas around the northern Iraqi town of Sinjar from the Islamic State group after launching a new operation Thursday. Kurdish officials say their forces were in control of villages on either side of the town and had taken control of a key road on a major supply route between Islamic State-held Mosul to the east and the group's self-proclaimed capital to the west in Raqqa, Syria. The United Nations, African Union, and European Union are calling for talks between Burundi's government and the opposition to resolve that country's deepening political crisis. In a joint statement Thursday, top officials of all three bodies said it is urgent that the sides meet either in the Ethiopian or Ugandan capitals. The UN Security Council is expected to unanimously adopt a resolution Thursday calling for an end to violence in Burundi and threatening sanctions against anyone who stands in the way of the search for a peaceful solution. The measure expresses concern about ongoing escalation of insecurity in Burundi and the lack of dialogue among its parties. Diplomats in New York have said the UN could rush peacekeepers into Burundi if COM doesn't return soon to the East African nation. Authorities in Burundi, however, say the country is not in flames, that there is no chance of mass murder. Clashes briefly broke out Thursday between riot police and protesters in central Athens.
Russian sports are being rocked by
after competition over doping, Russian President Vladimir Putin said. This is VOA News. Clashes briefly broke out Thursday between riot police and protesters in central Athens during the first general strike since the country's left-led government initially came to power in January. Youths broke away from a protest march by thousands as it passed outside Parliament and threw Molotov cocktails at police who responded with tear gas and stun grenades. Demonstrators scattered, but calm returned within the hour. Some 25,000 people participated in three separate demonstrations in central Athens, according to police, to protest a new round of bailout-related tax hikes and spending cuts. Tiny Slovenia has become the latest in a line of nations putting up barriers against the surge of asylum seekers seeking to reach Western Europe. Slovenian police said Thursday they've erected 5 kilometers of the fence in one day, despite a border spat with neighboring Croatia. Slovenia insists it will not seal off entry, but the move shows European countries are increasingly acting on their own. Hungary's right-wing government has stopped all migrant traffic through its territory, with more than 200 kilometers of fence on its border with Serbia and Croatia. Union leader Donald Tusk says saving Europe's Schengen passport-free travel zone is going to be a race against time. That after Germany, Sweden, Slovenia, and other EU nations have acted unilaterally. Tusk spoke Thursday at the end of a European-African summit in Malta to find ways to send migrants who don't qualify for asylum back to their homelands and discourage more from leaving Africa. Tusk warned, without effective control of external borders, Schengen will not survive, he added. We must hurry, but without panic. Volkswagen is telling employees that they can come forward with information about how the company cheated on U.S. emissions tests, and they won't be fired. In a move to get to the bottom of the scandal more quickly, Volkswagen brand manager Herbert Diess told staff in a letter that the company will not seek damages or fire employees for what they might reveal. Workers could be transferred to other duties, however, and the company stresses it cannot get anyone off the hook for ongoing criminal probes. The offer is valid until November 30th and only applies to workers covered by collective bargaining agreements. Clashes broke out Thursday between riot police and youth in central Athens during the first general strike since the country's left-led government initially came to power in January. And the man who reigns as Zimbabwe's Mr. Ugly has tough competition in this year's pageant, with organizers saying they received a record number of entries.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The World Bank and UN groups that track maternal mortality report maternal death rates have fallen by 44% since 1990. While this is significant progress, the authors of the report say too many women still are dying from preventable causes, especially in sub-Saharan Africa.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting. We'll have full details on this story coming up. Also, the UN Security Council has unanimously adopted a resolution today calling for an end to violence in Burundi. A new report says more than 290 million women and girls in the world's poorest countries are now using modern contraceptives. And the controversial activity of trophy hunting continues to be a heated debate. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Mali, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, the UN Security Council has unanimously adopted a resolution today calling for an end to violence in Burundi. The resolution also threatens sanctions against anyone who stands in the way of the search for a peaceful solution. The measure was drafted by France. It expresses concern about ongoing escalation of insecurity and the lack of dialogue among its parties. It also urges all sides to cooperate with mediation efforts led by Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni. The resolution calls on Secretary General Ban Ki-moon to update the Council on the situation within 15 days and present options on the future presence of the UN in Burundi. Meanwhile, the AU is asking the East African Standby Force, a regional military intervention force, to be ready to deploy to Burundi if the situation gets worse. The AU and the UN are also considering sending some UN peacekeepers to Burundi that are currently stationed in the DRC. Also, Burundi's ruling party is accusing former colonial ruler Belgium of funding and arming the opposition in the country. The party's leader released a statement saying there will be no new massacres or genocide in Burundi. UN and U.S. officials and Rwandan President Paul Kagame have warned of the potential for ethnic conflict. In related news, the Associated Press reports some residents in Bujumbura who fled the violence months ago have returned home to find their homes and property looted. The looting was allegedly done by pro-government police and supporters. In our daily migrant news update, European Union leader Donald Tusk says the EU must act quickly to resolve its migrant crisis or risk losing control of its borders. Mr. Tusk spoke on the second day of a two-day summit in Malta among EU member states to discuss development aid to Africa and a solution to African migration to Europe. EU officials are meeting separately with representatives of certain African countries. Ethiopia is the first to sign an agreement. Others may follow. Leaders of Senegal and Niger have declared that a $2 billion aid package for Africa by the EU is not enough. Meanwhile, Sweden announced that anyone wishing to travel in or out of the country should carry a passport or other travel document. That is a reversal of one of the EU's central agreements, visa-free travel across borders. Also, the Prime Minister of Hungary has declared visa-free travel a dead issue and has sealed his borders with barbed wire fences and border guards. Slovenia has followed suit with another fence. The UN says nearly 800,000 migrants have arrived in Europe by sea this year, with more than 3,400 have died or gone missing. About 150,000 have come from African countries. Some 650,000 people, mostly Syrians, have arrived via Turkey and Greece. The EU is seeking a summit with Turkey to deal with migration issues from the Middle East. The The World Bank and UN groups that track maternal mortality report maternal death rates have fallen by 44% since 1990. While this is significant progress, the authors of the report say too many women still are dying from preventable causes, especially in sub-Saharan Africa. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
UN agencies tracking global rates of maternal mortality found that over the past 25 years, the risk of a woman dying from pregnancy-related causes has been cut nearly in half. But a new report on global mortality rates among maternal women suggests very mixed and uneven results. It shows the Millennium Development Goal of reducing maternal deaths by 75% by the end of this year has only been achieved by 9 countries. Only 2 African countries, Cape Verde and Rwanda, are among them. Lale Say is coordinator for reproductive health and research at the World Health Organization. She says maternal deaths worldwide in 1990 stood at 532,000. She says that number dropped to an estimated 303,000 in 2015.
For every 100,000 live births, there will be 216 women around the world who will die during 2015. This would mean that in 2015, around 830 women are dying from pregnancy-related causes every day around the globe.
Say notes that about 99% of all maternal deaths are taking place in developing regions, with sub-Saharan Africa alone accounting for 2 in 3 deaths. While that number is clearly far too high, she says it nonetheless represents a major improvement from the past. She says maternal mortality rates in sub-Saharan Africa have decreased by 45% from 987 to 546 per 100,000 live births between 1990 and 2015. She says Eastern Asia has made the greatest improvement, reducing maternal deaths by 72% over the past 25 years.
We know why mothers die. They die from severe bleeding, from infections, complications from unsafe abortion, and hypertensive disorders of pregnancy. And we also know that most of these deaths are preventable.
UN health officials say improving access to quality health care with trained health workers on hand during and after childbirth can save many lives. They say women and girls must be provided with contraception, safe abortions, and essential medicines to treat problems that may arise. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A new report says more than 290 million women and girls in the world's poorest countries are now using modern contraceptives. The report's been released today by Family Planning 2020, an international partnership supporting women's rights to decide for themselves when to have children and how many. Beth Slachter is Executive Director of Family Planning 2020.
By July 2015, we saw an unprecedented number of women and girls using modern methods of contraception. The total in the 69 FC 2020 focus countries is 290 million women and girls, and that means compared to July 2012, there are 24.4 million more women and girls using modern contraception in these 69 focus countries. From July 2014 to July 2015, 80 million unintended pregnancies were prevented because of the use of modern contraception. 26.8 million unsafe abortions were averted, and 111,000 maternal lives were saved.
However, she says despite an increase of nearly 24.5 million women and girls since 2012, more must be done to improve access to family planning.
So our goal for 2015 was to add an additional 34 million users to the 2012 baseline. But as you can see, we've fallen short of that goal by about 10 million. The rate of progress was always projected to be somewhat slower in the early years, so it's critical that we accelerate efforts now in order to reach the 2020 goal and ensure that we're well-positioned to make our 2030 goals under the Sustainable Development Goals.
The 2020 goal is to have an additional 120 million women and girls with access to family planning methods.
The partnership aims to ultimately create an environment that ensures that every woman and girl has the right and the means to shape her own life and plan the family she wants well beyond 2020. Therefore, it's important to remember that FP 2020 progress is not defined solely by that numeric shortfall. The numbers don't fully capture the important momentum that we've seen since the London summit. Taken together, more than 80 FP 2020 commitments add up to an enormous, unprecedented global undertaking to bring health and empowerment to millions of women and girls. Our challenge remains that we build on this momentum to realize the promise, our promise, to provide access to information, services, and supplies to more people every year while maintaining and growing programs that provide quality services that meet the specific needs of each individual woman and girl.
Beth Slachter is Executive Director of Family Planning 2020. Reuters says five civilians died yesterday and 20 rebels were killed during a terrorist attack on a village in Niger. The village is in the Basso district of Niger. The report came from military officials in the Difa district, which borders Nigeria. Almost a third of Difa's nearly 600,000 inhabitants have been displaced by the violence. Boko Haram insurgents in Nigeria have killed thousands and displaced about 2 million in Nigeria in the past 6 years. They've attacked neighboring countries. The UN says a long-awaited regional military task force is to confront the Islamist fighters when the region's rainy season ends. French Radio International says the French army has announced they cannot provide security for Pope Francis' November 30th visit to the Central African Republic. Military officials in Paris have advised that the Pope cancel his stop in Bangui, the capital. Pope Francis is weighing the advisability of going to the CAR to seek an end to religious conflict in the country. He plans to conduct a mass at the capital's Notre Dame Cathedral and meet with imams at a major mosque in the city. The visit will end his African tour to Kenya and Uganda. Since the overthrow of CAR's President Francois Bozize in 2013, Christian anti-Balaka militias have been battling Muslim Seleka rebels. A transitional government is holding national elections on December 27th to elect a president and parliament. An October surge in sectarian killing forced the delay of an earlier vote. The UN peacekeeping mission in CAR is adding hundreds of troops and police for the election, but too late for the Pope's visit. There are currently 9,000 peacekeepers in the country. Cecil the Lion may no longer be with us, but his death in a controversial hunting episode in Zimbabwe has brought attention to the issue of trophy hunting. Now, more than 4 months after Cecil's death at the hands of an American hunter, VOA's Anita Powell looks at how the hunting debate has changed.
Call it the Cecil effect. The killing of the black-maned Zimbabwean lion by an American dentist in July has reverberated beyond southern Africa and sparked a heated debate on what role trophy hunting should play in the region. And in a rare point of agreement, both sides of this debate agree that the lion's death has brought about positive change and greater awareness of trophy hunting, whether you agree with it or not. Zimbabwe Professional Hunters and Guides Association Chairman Louis Muller says the highly publicized death of Cecil inspired his organization to take a hard look at itself and to try to do things better.
The Cecil effect has affected everybody, not just Zimbabwe. It has affected trophy hunting as a whole in the entire globe. I think we realize that we've got to be more transparent as an industry. I think we've got to clean up the act and be more self-regulatory so that where there are rogue elements within our industry, we've got to address them and be very serious with these individuals before the authorities step in. We've got to clean up our act before the politicians step in, because then there'll generally be a knee-jerk reaction.
Hunting advocates argue trophy hunting is a good way to cull herds and preserve fragile environments. Muller also says the income from trophy hunting helps children by bringing income and investment to rural communities. An official with the National Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, Isabel Wenzel, says her group is totally against trophy hunting. She calls it a blood sport. But she says Cecil's death has opened the door for positive change.
It's caused a huge outcry, but it has forced a few governments to actually sit up and notice that there's something maybe needs to be done that there must be a reason why that it's caused such an outcry. So there has been different steps in the direction of legislation. Even in our country, there's definitely been a better look at it. And of course, America is trying to bring in other laws. So yes, it has caused quite a ripple effect.
This debate has come too late for Cecil. But as humans argue about what happened and how he has changed the game, the beloved lion, in a way, lives on. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
For millions of sub-Saharan Africans, access to health care has been elusive, and the West Africa Ebola outbreak uncovered many weaknesses in national health care systems. Lately, many global health experts have begun to shift attention from centralized city hospitals and regional clinics to grassroots communities where health care workers can live among those they serve. Since 2013, Columbia University's Earth Institute has waged a campaign to train, supervise, and supply 1 million community health care workers in Africa. VOA's Adam Phillips reports from New York.
The Earth Institute's 1 million community health workers campaign has a grand goal: access to health care for every man, woman, and child in sub-Saharan Africa. Prabhjot Singh is the campaign's co-founder and the senior advisor.
The 1 million community health worker campaign is an extraordinary opportunity, especially in a post-Ebola response world, where we understand that where there's a breakdown of community trust for the lack of primary healthcare systems, you need dedicated people, individuals who really understand communities, who can be equipped, supported, and form the web of healthcare access, which is ultimately necessary to build the future of sub-Saharan African healthcare systems.
Sharon Kim, the campaign's deputy director, says to do this, community health workers need to be properly trained, supported, and respected.
For example, we'd like them to be fully equipped with all of the supplies that they need, including backpacks, mobile phones, sometimes transportation like bicycles or motorcycles. They need adequate training. It's really important that they always have a supervisor. They should be remunerated, which is not really the case in many countries around the world.
In the past, there was poor coordination among governments, NGOs, donors, and grassroots community leaders. That led to inefficiency. For instance, funding often went to training local health workers to recognize and treat a single disease. But if a patient had a different disease or several diseases at once, there was little that health worker could do. Prabhjot Singh says the geographical and cultural distance between grassroots community leaders and other stakeholders has often meant confusion, mistrust, and wasted resources.
There are a whole range of community leaders. At the same time, there's regional health directors, there's primary clinic leaders, and there are people that ultimately need to advocate for community health workers themselves. Because there's so many people involved, the Million Community Health Worker campaign has focused on bringing together the whole group to really understand how to create some sort of stable offering to rural places across sub-Saharan Africa.
Ghana is one country where the 1 million community health workers campaign is getting promising results. Indeed, Ghana's president recently announced his commitment to hire and train 10,000 youth to serve as local health workers. It's a plan that would help address community health care, youth unemployment, and poverty at the same time. And these young people would be required to keep meticulous client health records.
And also help us to keep track various disease patterns in the country to inform policy as well as intervention.
That's Chief Nathaniel Ibo Nusarko, a traditional Ashanti leader and a health specialist for the 1 million community health workers campaign in Ghana.
It's a very good campaign for us to run, particularly in our part of the country where we have a lot of deprived communities.
Over half of Ghana's people live in remote villages with no access to electricity, clean water, or internet or telephone access. And the World Health Organization estimates that in sub-Saharan Africa overall, 10 to 20% of children die before their fifth birthday. Maternal death statistics are just as grim. Chief Nathaniel sees a profound underlying connection there.
Just imagine a pregnant woman who is about to deliver and having to be transported on a deplored road for about an hour or sometimes more to the next health facility And that has been some of the issues that has contributed to the maternal mortality rate. We see healthcare as a necessity, not a privilege. And therefore, there is a need for us to extend healthcare to the people wherever they live. And once you involve the community in the whole approach, they will begin to understand and own it and want to contribute.
The Earth Institute's 1 million community health workers campaign also maintains an online operations room where national, regional, and local health officials can know at a glance how many community health workers are at a given locale and how much training and support they have. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
An international peace group says with a peace deal in place in South Sudan, politicians have a chance to provide better leadership. Activists with the Geneva-based Initiatives of Change International say the focus in South Sudan should now be on trust building, ethical leadership, and sustainable living for all. Reporter Philip Thon Aliyu met with the activists who just wrapped up an 8-day visit to Juba.
Mike Brown is a coordinator for the Geneva-based Initiative of Change International, or IOFC's Working Group for South Sudan. Brown says the effort to reconcile South Sudan's different ethnic communities started in mid-2013, before President Kiir appointed religious leaders to lead that work. Brown says the IOFC has supported the church-led efforts for peace and reconciliation. He says the signed peace deal should help mend broken social ties.
So much effort went into creating the agreement, but it is really only an opening. How will those who have fought each other trust each other now to build government and make things work? That's why we've come, and we want to work mainly with the churches, because they are the local agency here on the ground with a long track record in trust building. But we have some programs like Leadership in Traumatized Society and Creators of Peace. So we're offering these programs.
The IOCF trained 200 peace mobilizers in Juba during May of 2013 and another 180 in Torit and Yei in 2014. He says they will help spread messages of peace to their communities.
The distinctive thing about initiatives of change is that it starts with the individual. It starts with each individual realizing they can be part of an answer. They can be part of bringing healing, forgiveness, and reconciliation in their community, in their workplace, and then in the country.
Nyonga Chuoz heads the South Sudan Australia Peace Initiative, which works with initiatives of change. He says the South Sudanese people must be told it is possible to peacefully coexist. Nyong describes a recent meeting his group held with religious leaders as fruitful.
Trust is the most important thing that initiative of change is hoping to help bring in how these leaders can find somehow a way to trust one another and do the work together. And we as people will continue to do our best to make sure that the voiceless and those that are suffering across the country, their cry is heard.
Catherine Gore, a member of the South Sudan Australia Peace Initiative, says women must be allowed to play a prominent role in bringing about lasting peace. She says her group has created peace cycles for young women and mothers.
We create a space that is confidential and safe so that women feel that they are able to share, but there is no pressure. So in that space, when there is safety and connection with other women, we often find that, yes, people will want to share something that has been hurting them.
Gore says women will network in towns and villages through community meetings, churches and marketplaces to spread the message of peace. The initiatives of change operates in three other countries, including Kenya, Syria, Afghanistan, and Zimbabwe. For VOA News, I'm Plifton Aliu in Juba.
This is African News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and it's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni is facing his toughest challenge yet. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests as they explore the possibility of major opposition leaders, former Prime Minister Amama Mbabazi and Dr. Kizza Besigye joining forces in next year's Ugandan poll. That's next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The UN Security Council is expected to unanimously adopt a resolution today calling for an end to violence in Burundi. And a new report shows too many women are still dying from preventable causes of maternal death, especially in sub-Saharan Africa. Coming up, we'll have music from Mali and our feature segment. I'm Kim Lewis, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Thursday, Sunny.
Happy Thursday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you have lots and lots of African football news for us today.
Lots and lots of African football on my sporty plate, Kim. We're going to kick off with African football. Guinea and the Democratic Republic of Congo both posted big road victories Thursday in 2018 World Cup qualifying matches. In Windhoek, Guinea defeated host Namibia 1-0 on a goal by Nabi Keita in the 27th minute. And in Bujumbura, the DRC rallied to beat Burundi 3-2. The hero for the Congolese was Ndombe Mubele, who came on as a second-half substitute and lifted his team to victory with goals in the 86th and 88th minutes. Yannick Bolasie opened the scoring for the DRC in the fifth minute. Cedric Amisi had a brace for Burundi to put the home team up 2-1 before the late-game heroics by Mubele. Our VOA World Cup fans will remember, these African qualifiers are over two legs, home and away, and by November 17th, we'll know the 20 African teams advancing to the final round of qualifying. Guinea and the DRC now look like good bets to go through after their road victories on Thursday. The second leg matches are on Sunday. Because of the lingering Ebola cases in Guinea, Guinea will play Namibia in Casablanca, Morocco. And the Democratic Republic of Congo now carries that 3-2 advantage against Burundi into the second leg in Kinshasa. In 2018 World Cup qualifying results Wednesday, host Mozambique edged Gabon 1-0 on a goal by Helder Palembe in the 54th minute. And the fans of the Chipolopolo of Zambia had reason to cheer. The 2012 Nations Cup champion scored a 1-0 road victory over Sudan on a goal by Winston Kalengo in the 28th minute. Joining us now for a look at Friday's 2018 World Cup qualifying fixtures is our African football guru, David Legge.
A lot of fixtures on Friday, so I mean nine in all, starting with Madagascar, Senegal, and Comoros, Ghana, Kenya, Cape Verde, Libya, Rwanda. Because of post-Muammar Gaddafi era violence in Libya, that match is going to have to be played in Tunisia. A big one, Angola against South Africa. We've got Niger against Cameroon, Liberia against Ivory Coast, Mauritania against Tunisia, and Swaziland against the Super Eagles of Nigeria. Senegal, Sunny, they shouldn't have too many problems against Madagascar. 79-place gap between those countries on the world rankings. But the most lopsided tie of all, if you look at it from a rankings perspective, is that between the Comoros, an island state off the southeast coast of Africa, and the Black Stars of Ghana, a staggering 147 place difference in favor of Ghana. The Comoros, Sunny, are ranked 177 in the world and Ghana 30. So it doesn't take a lot of courage to say that Ghana are the favorites to win this one. And it's a Ghana side that recently, Sunny, were in your neck of the wood, Washington, D.C. They played Canada there and they drew 1-1. But they were missing two key components of their side. That's the midfielder, Andre Ayew, and the striker, who's recently had his share of injury problems, Asamoah Gyan. Now, they're both back for Ghana. if form means anything in football, you would expect Ghanaians to win the first leg in the Comores by several goals. And then I fear a little bit for the Comores in the return match. If Ghana are really goal hungry, and they put 7 past Mauritius in the Cup of Nations recently, it could become rather one-sided. But we wish Comores the best. It's interesting, Sonny, that they reached the second round without winning a game. They didn't win a game in 2010 or 2014 qualifiers. And more recently, they drew at Lesotho 0-0 at home and 1-1 away, so they qualified on the away goal rule. And that's how they secured that date against Ghana. Kenya against Cape Verde, when I looked at the rankings, I got a real shock. I thought these sides won't be that far apart. In actual fact, Sonny, there are 93 places between them. That's a staggering difference. Cape Verde, a group of islands similar to the Comores, 500,000 people. In fact, there are more Cape Verdeans living outside of Cape Verde than inside the country itself. And that is where most of the national team comes from. And they are ranked 32nd in the world. Kenya, on the other hand, for long the great hope of East Africa, but a side that unfortunately fail, and fail again to make a real impact in international football. They are ranked 125th. Now, on that basis, Sonny, I have to stick with logic and say it's going to be Cape Verde. Libya and Rwanda, as mentioned previously, that match will be in Tunisia. The Libyans are a huge disadvantage. They're not playing regular football because of the problems in their homeland. And Rwanda have been one of the more impressive, what I would call, middleweight African football nations recently. Winning away to Mozambique was a good result for them. And then they held Ghana for 87 minutes in Kigali in another Cup of Nations qualifier before losing to a goal off a free kick. They've got a very young coach, Johnny McKinstry from Northern Ireland. So I'm going with Rwanda. The Angola-South Africa tie is interesting, Sonny, because it's the only one that involves two countries that have previously qualified for the World Cup. South Africa made it in 98, 2002, and then again as hosts in 2010. Angola shocked Nigeria by qualifying in 2006. This match is going to be played in Benguela, and the South Africans are very confident. I'm just worried that they might be a little bit overconfident. Their coach, Ephraim Sheikh Mashaba, is talking about scoring goals in Angola and winning the first leg. Now, I looked at the statistics, Sonny, and what's interesting is that Angola has played 29 home World Cup qualifiers, won 18, drawn 10, and they've lost only one. That only defeat came way back in 1990 against the Cameroon side, who went on to reach the World Cup quarterfinals. So that is a formidable home record. The South African away record in World Cup qualifiers is 9 victories, 3 draws, and 6 losses. So, to put it mildly, this is going to be a really interesting contest. It's like a real Southern African showdown. I think what Angola will be looking for is at least a 1-0 home victory. I think not allowing South Africa to score, I think, will be a crucial part of the Angolan plan. Niger against Cameroon. Cameroon now with a new coach in Alexander Bilinga. He's replaced the German Volker Fink, and this is a tie they should win. Liberia against Ivory Coast. Ivory Coast have been hard hit by injuries, and also the decision of Yaya Toure to remain on the sidelines for the moment. He hasn't announced his official retirement, but he has not played since Ivory Coast won the Cup of Nations in February. And when I say hasn't played, of course, I'm talking about national team duty. The injuries are a rule out, among others, Thomas Toure, Solomon Kalou, and that's a real pity because he scored a hat-trick for Hertha Berlin at the weekend. And Liberia, an interesting team. They drew 1-1 at home with Guinea-Bissau in the previous round and then went to Guinea-Bissau and scored a 3-1 victory. And all 4 goals in that tie came from William Jebor. He's based in Portugal, but he plays in Spain, and he is clearly a player the Ivorians are going to have to watch very closely. Mauritania are an improving side, recent 3-1 home winners over South Africa. And I think they'll give the Tunisians a tough fight in Nouakchott, but perhaps not such a tough fight in the return match. And I guess the same applies, Sonny, to Swaziland against Nigeria. The Swazis, boosted by that recent win over Guinea in Morocco, they'll be up for a good fight against the Super Eagles in Lobamba, which is between Manzini and the commercial center of Swaziland. But over two legs, you would have to fancy the Nigerians. So on the Friday matches, Sonny, looking at them as ties, I'm going for Senegal, Ghana, Cape Verde, Rwanda, South Africa, Cameroon, Ivory Coast, Tunisia, and Nigeria.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. Let's take a short break now for this programming announcement from my good friend in Nigeria's commercial capital.
Hi, I'm Segun Adeyemi, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports. Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports from the Voice of America. Let the games begin.
We got the game on.
Game on, VOA sports fans. Joining us now with more African football news is our Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Ouma.
Defending champions Kenya will open their title defense campaign against perennial rivals Uganda at the Council of East and Central Africa Football Association's CECAFA Senior Challenge Cup in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia on the 22nd of November. CECAFA General Secretary Nicolas Musonye revealed in Nairobi that Burundi and Zanzibar are also in Group B. Group A consists of hosts Ethiopia, Rwanda, Tanzania mainland and Somalia, while Group C features Sudan, guest side Malawi, South Sudan, and Djibouti.
Thanks, Mark. That's Mark Ouma of our Daybreak Africa radio show, which you can tune in Monday through Friday on The Voice of America. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. If you go to my Facebook page today, Thursday, you'll see a photo of 63-year-old George Haywood. George lives right here in Washington, and he won the gold medal in the 300-meter hurdles at this year's World Masters Athletics Championships in Lyon, France. And in George's words, my best days are ahead of me. Hope, positivity, mind-body connection. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Kim Lewis.
All right. Thank you, Sonny. Thanks for that exciting report. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on The Voice of America. Well, coming up, Zimbabwe youth see gambling as a means of putting food on the table. And African immigrants in Europe are making a decent living in the highly competitive yogurt industry. First, here's Salif Keita of Mali with Yambo.
Na don't get up. Na don't get up.
Salif Keita with Yambo. Well, with high unemployment in economically troubled Zimbabwe, youth are placing their bets on gambling, and they're calling it real work that sometimes puts food on the table. VOA's Arthur Chigoriwa reports from Harare.
Muzalelo Dentist Suburb youth, 21-year-old Shakespeare Mulilo, says in the absence of jobs in the country, he has taken to betting, hoping by luck he can make a dollar to live by, as many struggle to make ends meet. Molilo said he and other youth have resorted to gambling to earn a living, as company closures have seen the number of jobs available on the market continuing to dwindle. It's now more of who you know, even to get the smallest of jobs. On a good day, he says he can get as much as $500 after betting with just $1.
To myself and others, it will be like a form of employment, because rather than to wait for any money outside, it will be difficult to find it. But on betting, you just bet on or even a dollar. Then it comes when you bet your teams. you will find out you have won maybe 140, 500 and some, or like us, like some of the who are not employed. It will be an advantage for them.
Betting shops are all over the place with the Africa Bet and Africa Lotto leading the way. The youth can bet on virtually anything that is of interest in a particular world sports. The shops are always packed. Sometimes there's not even room to stand as jobless youth try their luck in a bid to feed their families. Chikono Wono high-density suburb resident George Chitengo said he is surviving on British and Spanish soccer betting and often wins because he knows how the teams play. Another gambler who did not want to be identified said some like him take betting as a hobby and entertainment.
Maybe some of them, they find it as a hobby. Some people find it as a hobby, but most of them, it's a lack of employment. So betting is now sort of employment to them. And others, it's just a hobby. And others, just a sort of entertainment. For me, it's just a hobby. When I win, I enjoy the hobby. When I lose...
But some parents are not amused by the number of youth who have turned to gambling, which they say is a vice in the society. Alaska parent Atwell Mazarura is one such parent.
As a Christian country, our Christian principles forbid gambling. Besides that, the definition for gambling, for betting on gambling, is risking your money for a future event, an event of which you are not in control, of which you may not even calculate the probability.
Spoken Word Ministry Pastor Tonderai Makaya says as a church they are not surprised by the number of youth turning to gambling. He says it is a sign of the times. Makaya says this shows that people are in extreme poverty and like those who gambled during the Bible times, they are desperate to earn a living.
We find it in the book of Nehemiah. People, they were gambling with their inheritance. The reason, because most of them, those people, they were left in Israel. Other people, they went to Babylon. They don't have a source of... In fact, they were now logged country without any assistance from other people. Because most of the people, they're supposed to go out because of poverty, because of... You know, lack of anything. They start to sell their thing or they start to gamble with their property. By the end, in fact, Nehemiah, when he comes back, he says, no, guys, why are you doing this?
But due to the increased clientele base from mainly the youth, Africa Bet and Africa Lotto have opened more than 100 outlets throughout the country. Reporting in Chinoyi, this is Ata Chigoriwa.
Coffee houses are springing up all over Kenya's capital city. Carolyn Turner reports on one of the entrepreneurs in this growing cafe industry.
Pete's Cafe was started 5 years ago by Peter Owiti. He learned the industry by working for one of Kenya's first coffee shop chains.
Our customers can now order like specialty coffee that is made or brewed for them specifically. You might say, today I don't want to drink a Kenyan, I want to drink a Ugandan, I want to drink Tanzanian. Anything you want here, you can get. I think that's the differentiation between us and what the other cafes are offering. And definitely it's a top dollar coffee that we offer.
More than the beverage, free Wi-Fi and an easy atmosphere have cultivated a new coffee culture that draws people who just want to hang out, as well as the business community.
You know, like for me, I have, yes, an office space, but sometimes because of... I kind of find my office space, you know, it's too confined, yeah?
It's like a conversation starter, because borrowing from African culture, anytime you're invited for a meal, anytime you're invited for a drink, it's more than just the meal or just the drink.
Kenya produces close to 1 million bags of coffee annually, but this is small compared with Uganda and Ethiopia. Its specialty coffee is highly sought after by roasters who blend it with coffees from other nations. At least 90% of Kenya's coffee is exported, At one time, it was Kenya's leading foreign exchange earner, but unpredictable weather and falling world prices have reduced production. Now the growing coffee culture brings new potential. Coffee lover Kwi Wanjiri says Kenyans need to connect to the unique status that their coffee enjoys in other countries.
Slowly we're getting to that point where we're like, no, why is it so nice? Why do other people like it? Let's give it a shot. Let me see what it's like in my own house.
Coffee giant Starbucks currently sources coffee from 9 African countries. It's expected to make its entry into sub-Saharan Africa next year. Mukil Shaw is the CEO of Eat Out Kenya, an online food and restaurant guide.
You've seen a change from, say, what we would call mom and pop shops, where family-run small restaurants, moving towards huge international franchises. And, you know, big brands coming in from the rest of the world.
Industry experts say the new coffee culture means there is room for competition.
They've been exposed to some of the best coffee shops around, so they have an awareness of these different, you know, offerings that they can get. So when they come home and, you know, Kenya, we actually make coffee, we grow coffee, expectations have grown, they've raised.
Kenya's biggest coffee market is still abroad, and analysts say the growing local consumption is unlikely to shift demand. But with more interest at home, coffee lovers hope finer quality will be more widely available. Carolyn Turner, VOA News.
This is Africa News tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
An international public service announcement by the United States government.
Saif al-Adel is a fugitive and suspected high-ranking member of the Al-Qaeda terror network who was wanted in connection with the 1998 bombings of the U.S. embassies in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, and Nairobi, Kenya. He is an Egyptian citizen with black hair and dark eyes. He is also believed to be affiliated with the Egyptian Islamic Jihad. He is also known as Ibrahim al-Madani and Muhammad Ibrahim Makawi. Hundreds of people were killed in the embassy attacks and thousands wounded, most Kenyan and Tanzanian citizens. 12 Americans died. For these and other acts, al-Adel is charged with murder, conspiracy to destroy United States property, and other crimes. The Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $5 million for information leading to al-Adel's arrest or prosecution. The U.S. guarantees that all reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them. If you have information on this man, contact the Regional Security Office at the nearest U.S. embassy and the tip line at www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to rfj@state.gov.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Escape from the humdrum and dance to the beat of an African drum. Hi, I am David Van, host of the Voice of America's African Beat. Splendid sounds from the continent that all humanity calls home. Join me Monday through Friday at 0900 and 2000 UTC for a soothing musical journey. I guarantee it.